way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, May the 21st, 2026, which means we're just exactly 1 month away from the summer solstice. Yes, June 21st. But you know what that means? We're 1 day less away from. Happy birthday to TSP. Yes, the Survival Podcast will turn 18 years old on June 20th, 2026. I guess we'll be legally an adult in the world of podcasting. And if that's the standard, there's not many legal adult podcasts out there, are there? Very, very, very few. No Agenda would be one of them. I don't think there's many others. Anyway, let's talk about what we're going to talk about today. Talk about what we're going to talk about. Dan McAdams and Ron, just a little bit from Ron Paul, mostly Dan McAdams. He's going to be asking a question and proposing several answers to it, and that is, did Thomas Massie, the representative from Kentucky, congressional representative from Kentucky, did he just get 2020'd? As in, have the election stolen. Like, not a PAC and a bunch of mega PACs threw in a bunch of money and ousted his ass, but did they actually cheat? Did boomers really break as hard as the polls say for Massie, upending the fact that he won every other demographic? Dan says maybe he did get 2020'd, as in, have the election stolen. I'm going to tell you that I think the actual answer is far more simple, and in some ways far more sinister. Andy McCann will talk about squatting ability as an indicator of your overall health. Ryan Steva will talk about the effectiveness of deep solar wells and give you a list of components that you can use in your projects if that is going to be something you're going to take on. Nicole Sauce, right before she ditches out and goes off on her vacation, which I think she actually left yesterday, off to the Greek Isles. I hope you have fun on your vacation, Nicole. You certainly have earned it. But she left us with a quick segment. How do you successfully incubate duck eggs? I can tell you from personal experience, it's not as simple as chicken eggs. It is, but it isn't. It'll make sense when Nicole explains it. Jesse Markowitz will be asked her a question. I bet you think it's like Start 9 or Bitcoin wallets or blockchain or not really, just maybe blockchain adjacent. What's up with Michael Saylor? What is he selling? What is MSTR? What is STRD? What is STRF? What is STRC, etc.? What does this all mean? And I'm going to have a little follow-up on this one about, see, I told you you didn't understand what Bitcoin is digital gold meant. Because I think most people never did. I think you're starting to see certain things take shape to show you what that meant for the last, 8 years that it's been said regularly. Jean Pugliano will talk about some other economic stuff, but to buy an IPO or to not buy an IPO, thoughts on SpaceX's coming IPO, index funds versus managed funds, and more. John gets a bunch into this one. Chef Ken Daniels then will show up with thoughts on making something to just blow away your guests at a dinner party, and including the experience itself. So that's a little bit of a longer one than I let them get away with usually, but I understand getting carried away with yourself a little bit on food stuff, so that one will run about 9 minutes. Then I will have a short closing segment for you today. I promise it will be short. But I'm going to talk about why we focus on problems we have no influence over versus the problems in our circle of control. Including like really big problems, at least we convince ourselves are problems. Some of them are, some of them aren't. But either way, we don't really have any control over them. But that's what we put our mental energy into. I think we all know this is a problem. We all know about Stephen Covey's circle of concern and circle of influence. And eventually, that whole model being built into like a circle of control, a circle of influence, and a circle of concern. And we all know it's a thing, and we all know that it happens. But do we know why it happens? Why are some of you so worried about things and you think you're going to stop them and you want to know whether I oppose them or I support them? Do you oppose or support, I don't know, stick an NFL team in there. Does it matter? Does my support of the Pittsburgh Steelers mean they're going to do a better job drafting or recruiting, right? Does my opposition to the Baltimore Ravens prevent them from making the playoffs? And those things are much smaller than some of the things that these people seem to worry about all the time and worry about whether or not I support or oppose them. It's not about me, though. It's about you. Why do we let this happen to ourselves? And what is the danger in constantly allowing to happen? And how is the fact that we are predisposed to do so being used against you in reality? All right, so here we go. Let's go ahead and drop on in and hear from Dr. Paul, just a little bit from Dr. Paul, mostly Dan McAdams on, did Thomas Massey just get 2020'd?
We don't know what happened. We don't know if there was any cheating that was going on. But a lot of people had the feeling that there were some anomalies that are very, very serious. And I have a couple of them here. I and a lot of other people had that same feeling that we had in 2020 when Joe Biden was campaigning from his basement. He didn't do any public events. He didn't do any debates, really. He did the first debate. Well, he did one debate, and it was a disaster. Didn't hardly do interviews. Everything was safe and controlled. Well, that's the situation with Gowron, the fellow who supposedly won. He refused to debate. He missed 8 debates. He didn't do interviews. He didn't have rallies. And if he did, there were a couple of token people there. The guy was a complete cipher. And so people are rightly scratching their heads saying, this reminds me a lot of 2020 when we believe, or certainly there was a lot of evidence that Trump got ripped off in 2020, and a lot of people believe that, and I think it's probably the case. Ironically, now it looks like Trump did the same. Trump did a 2020 to Thomas Massey, but I have a couple of things. Now, we don't know, but this is what people are saying. Sam Parker did a good job putting some things together. He said, did Massey get 2020'd? Now, the numbers can be a little bit confusing, but try to follow along if you can. Massey increased his turnout by 19% over 2024. But Gowron increased the opposition turnout by 357%. Today's turnout doubled 2024's in the highest overall vote in Kentucky history. Was this really driven by get-out-the-vote millions? Suspicious. Now, here's a chart of how the votes turned out. Are we really supposed to believe the boomers flooded the polls so hard that they overwhelmed every other demographic? Now, you look here, the 18 to 29-year-old voters, likely voters, 78.5% went for Massey. The 30 to 44, 64.9% went to Massey. Even the 45 to 64s went 53.3% for Massey. Gowron only won the 65-plus, who went 65% in his favor. Now, it's always possible, but this is very suspicious. Now, two more, Dr. Paul, I'm going to send it back to you. This next one, if you put it on, finishing out Sam Parker's views last night. Gowron didn't do any debates, and no grassroots showed up to his campaign events at all. But we're supposed to believe they came out to vote for him in record numbers? Massey also massively outraised Gowron in small dollar donations in both totals and numbers of donors. This is a huge signal of voter enthusiasm. But we're supposed to believe that Gowron's seniors and fewer small donors doubled the turnout from 2024. He says, LOL.
All right, so here's my view on this. I actually think Massey legitimately lost. I'm not going to say the game wasn't rigged economically. My understanding is AIPAC alone socked in $7 million. And I know we're always talking about billions and trillions with the national debt and the federal government. But let me tell you something. $7 million from a single donor entity to sway a House seat in a primary is unprecedented. And in Kentucky, it's beyond unprecedented. And there was another like $9 million kicked in by some group of mega PACs for Trump or whatever. And this was a couple of things, I think, on a surface level. One, it was vindictive by Trump. There is nothing Trump abhors more than someone he thinks should be his ally that chooses to be, in his mind anyway, his enemy. And Massey actually voted with Trump a hell of a lot more than he didn't. Massey was, I would say, you know, the person I'm about to conjure up, or a couple of people I'm about to conjure up, are in the Senate, not the House. But if you compare Massey to someone like people that I actually think are Republicans that are really more Democrats than Republicans, right? They just have an R after their name. Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, people like that. Thomas Massey has been far more a supporter of Trump's policies and proposals than those two people have, right? And there's a few others that I could put on that list. He wasn't really an enemy of Trump. What he was is an enemy of bullshit, waste, lies, and attacking the American people's sovereignty and our privacy and other things. And so he would often appear to get in the way of a bill that Trump wanted done, but it generally wasn't the bill itself that he was upset about. It would be something buried in the bill. And we all know these bills are, you know, hundreds of pages, sometimes over 1,000 pages long. And he actually would take the time between him and his assistants and pages and all to read the fucking bill and find the fucking shit and say, this is wrong. This shouldn't be here. And then he was shouted down by the MAGA people and everything, and you're really a Democrat and you're woke and you have TDS. It's like, no, I don't think we should empower more surveillance on the American people with this particular line in the bill. It's not really necessary for what the rest of the bill does. It was shit like that. But Trump wants what Trump wants. So now it's like, get him. And he attacks him, and then his ego comes in, so he makes calls to his buddies at his super PAC, and they come in, and Israel is more than happy with AIPAC to come in, because Thomas Massey never took a dime of Israeli lobby money, so they pump all the money in. But why? I mean, it's never happened before. Nothing like this has ever happened before in the Republican Party. There's been renegades and such that have been kind of ousted, and like the inner workings of the party just kind of push the lever a little bit and make sure that they don't make it through their next primary. It happens, and a lot of times they try to do it and they fail. This was a concerted effort to make sure it got done. So why? Here's what I'm going to tell you. I think it's more sinister than Dan's letting on. I want you to think about Republicans versus Democrats in the House. And I know we throw around uniparty a lot, but I want you to think about more just their tribal macro actions. I'm going to tell you that 99.5% of the time or more, when there's a contentious thing that splits on party lines, where you've got Democrats and Republicans pretty much like, you know which side they're going to be on, just on what letter comes after their name. And you can think of many instances of this. It is almost unheard of that a Democrat steps out of the control group of Democrats and voting in that block and votes with the Republicans. It's almost unheard of, period. It is, I can't think of the last time when the Democrats needed one more vote and a Democrat refused to go along. I can't think of one. Massey did it quite a few times. Because what he was leveraging was the fact that the Democrats will oppose anything with Trump's name attached to it, right? So if all the Democrats are opposed and a couple Republicans are with a slim majority, you can hold things back. That's what was going on there. It wasn't to help the Democrats, and the Democrats weren't on Massey's side. That was what was going on. And several other Republicans have tended to do this. None with the effectiveness, and none with the consistency, at least since Ron Paul retired, of Thomas Massey. And if you look at that thing, we all know this intrinsically, like the Democrats stick together, and so they get shit done when they have power. The Republicans have power, they don't get shit done constantly and consistently. You've got the House, you got the Senate, and you have a fuckload of excuses of why you can't do the things that you said you were going to do. You see how that works? And it's because they don't have the cohesiveness. And because there's many, many, many of them that are really slimy, that we call moderates, that are actually leftists, that are to clothe themselves in the suit of an elephant. Okay? That's the reasoning. But there are certain things the party wants. The two mafia families may be, they're both like the children of the real Don. Right, the real Don that's the head of the mafia. He's actually the corporate apparatus in this case. But beneath them, you have like these two brothers. You got David and Richard, right, fighting with each other, the Democrats and they do both have certain things they do want. And what the Republican side wants is they want that unity, that law. Even if you argue, debate, whatever, that's fine. But when it's time to do it, they want to be able to call everybody to the table and say, we're doing this. And they don't have that. They just made an example of Thomas Massie. They want a lockstep collectivist party like the Democrats have to fight the lockstep collectivist party the Democrats are. Now, some of you special children just heard Jack go, it's okay because they have to fight fire. I didn't say that. I refuse to even defend that. I'm just going to point out that some of you retards will say that. That's not what I said. I'm telling you what they're doing, and I started out with, it's more sinister than. So you should be able to take it from there. All right, let's talk about something totally different. Squatting ability, as in squats, like when you do squats with weights on your back, as an indicator of your overall health.
Hello and good morning. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage, and I am helping you look good for your spouse and become harder to kill for your insurance people. So anyway, I got some more questions from the live stream I did with Jack a while back. This one comes from an old member of ours back here in Woodstock. Actually, he is the one that led me to this whole survival podcast, Jack Spirico stuff, and I appreciate it so much. So Bruce Sofji, who now is living the life in just at the Pontchartrain, I think, or somewhere in that area, he's got two questions because that's how Bruce works. If he can get one, he'll get two. I love it. Here we go. All right. Yeah, reading out loud. I pre-read it, and I'm going to try to go for this thing. I have heard you... oh, man, I already messed up. I have heard your squat can be a good indicator of your health and future longevity. A lifetime of sitting in a chair robs us of our flexibility, mobility, ankles, knees, hips, and spine. Yeah, that's true. My orthopedic says I cannot recover from knee range of motion after all these very old surgeries. YouTube says I can. Okay, this is great. Doctors versus YouTube. Thank you, Bruce. I'm going to go ahead and throw in right here, I am not a doctor, and I mostly speak from my own personal experiences and what I've seen at the gym. So go do your own research, but I'll give you my 2 cents. Anyway, I'm working hard, but seeing little progress. Andy, have you seen older folks in your gym recover full squat depth? And if so, how? So, okay, so the question is, if they've had injuries, can they recover it? The answer is yes, I have, and slowly. I would say the best advice I can give is go buy the knees over toe guy's thing. So he's on YouTube. Let me go find him for you. All right, so it's if you go to YouTube and you look for at the knees over toe guy, all one word, you'll find his stuff. It's got him with the bar on his back, and he's got this huge, massive squat with his knee way out over his toe, which you would think, oh, you can't do that. I followed some of this. I know I've done an answer for somebody else a while ago about this same subject. I would just hire his thing or buy his little pamphlet. I think it's $50, or at least it was when I did it, and follow along. The answer is yes, you can recover. It's just slow. And you want it to be slow and methodical. You don't want to jump into it. Your body wants to heal itself. If you give it proper nutrition and you train it to the range of motion you want, you're going to get that over time. Now, I'll caveat that with, hey, I had surgery and they shortened my tendon. Okay, that's going to be a whole different thing. Or I have brand new knees. I go, okay, well, that should be good, right? Or they did a thing, like they fused a thing, like my spine. Okay, so if they fused your spine, it's never going to really work the same because they fused it. You got to work within the boundaries of that problem. But the answer is yes, I have seen people, including myself, recover from issue. It just takes time and specific focus. Okay, so on to question B. Oh, I remember this. It's a personal question. Can you comfortably hang out in a full squat for 30 minutes or more? No. Easy answer, I cannot. I can sit down there in that full squat. Like, think of like you're watching an Aborigine out in Australia and he just like hangs out in that deep squat. No, I can't do that. I can do that for about 5 minutes. I just don't train it that much. I think it's worthwhile, and I think it does say a lot about your flexibility, mobility, and possibly longevity. But no, I cannot for 30 minutes. He said, can you do this at your desk? Yeah, I mean, those desks go up and down, those elevating desks. So you could do that, drop it down. At least I think you can. The one that I'm thinking of from my buddy's office, it actually almost goes all the way down to the floor. So it is possible to set up your lifestyle so that you can do that. I would say practice it. I would also say like video it to make sure you're doing the right thing and send it to me, or you know, check out somebody else's video online of a deep squat. Let me actually grab you guys one. Yeah, okay, so I just put in deep squat therapy into YouTube, and the first ones that I'm looking at, I love the position of all these guys. I think this. There's a video of this one girl using the uprights like a door jam, and I showed you guys at the fall workshop you can do this. I love the door jam approach until you don't need it anymore. You want to get away from having to use a door jam, but if it helps you get down into that squat, I think that's great. So use a door jam. She's actually using an upright from the one of the rig bars, which is super stable, but a door jam would do the exact same thing. Hey, Bruce, man, thank you for the softballs. I appreciate that. And for calling me out for not being able to squat for 30 minutes in a deep squat. On a good note, or another note, thank you also for the several texts I got afterwards and emails about Evan, my son, who was fighting a Crohn's diagnosis. He is doing great. I sent him some of y'all's inspiration. He's like, man, Dad, that is awesome. What about me coming to the fall workshop next year? I'm like, yeah, dog, let's do it. So anyway, Evan and I may be there. Thank you for making this community great, not only for me, but also my son, who is, you know, coming out of UGA with a computer science degree amongst all this AI and had to go through Crohn's while there. So anyway, thank you guys.
I would just, the only add-on I'll have is on the regaining of abilities. People who do not attempt to regain ability do not regain ability 100% of the time. And many people who attempt to regain abilities, even when they're told that they can't, do. Right? So there's no reason to not attempt to regain an ability. Except, like, I mean, if you lost your legs, you have no legs at all, and you want to walk without prosthetics, you want to, like, grow your legs back, we're not there with technology, and sheer will won't make that happen. There are some limitations. I went to an extreme as an example. But there's a lot of things that people are told, you won't ever be able to do this again. And if I had a dollar for every time somebody was told by a doctor that they would not be able to do something again, that person then did again over and over consistently after deciding to walk their own path, I would be an incredibly wealthy man. I might not be Elon Musk rich, but I'd probably be Donald Trump rich, okay? I'm just making a point here. I'm talking billions of times this has happened across history. The fact that I know a handful of people that I can think of that I know on a first name basis that have had things like this said to them. Hell, I had this said to me. I had a knee injury a few years, more than a few years ago now, about 2014, I guess, that a doctor said without surgery, you will never be able to have full use of your knee again. Now, he was wrong. And I had full use of my knee in about 4 to 5 months when that happened. I'm just saying, right? And again, it's not every time, and I'm not saying to always, you know, ignore what doctors say or what have you. But things like this, it's worth the effort. And what I love that Andy says sometimes, he didn't really say it today, but I've heard Andy say this more than once, when you don't do a thing for long enough, your body decides, I guess I don't need to do that thing anymore, and it stops maintaining the ability, and the ability begins to atrophy. And you can see it real easy with, you know, like somebody's in a coma for like a month, even just 1 month laying in a bed without moving, they have a lot of muscle atrophy. And when they come to, even if they come to the point where they mentally, cognitively, and neurologically have control of their body, they can wiggle their toes and all, they kind of have to learn to walk again because their body has just not bore its own weight for that long. And so, yeah, I guarantee you, if you don't try, your doctor will be correct. And if you do try sensibly, your doctor may be indeed proven wrong. Okay, now let's talk about deep solar wells with Ryan Steva and using solar pumps for them.
Hey, TSB community, this is Ryan Steva from thehomesteadconsultant.com. Today I've got a question from Jeff, and Jeff asks, do solar well pumps really work for deep wells? And Jeff, the answer is pretty definitively yes. They actually work quite well. I've got some experience with them. I've installed one and seen some others, and every experience that I've had with them has been very positive. I've got one that's been up and running for a year, basically running nonstop anytime the sun is out. And I'll explain that system as I go, but basically you can get pumps that will run up to about 1,400 feet of depth. So basically any well you would have, you can get a direct solar well pump that will work well for it. Of course, there's caveats where a well pump is not going to create constant back pressure to your home, so you need a way to store the water when you pump it up. And Jeff has that, so I'll read the rest of his question here. My household water supply comes from a 1,000-gallon underground cistern that is filled by a 450-foot deep well pump. I'd like to convert my grid pump to an off-grid solar system for cost savings and safety when the power is out. My property is surrounded by canyon walls that reduce the hours of direct sunlight to about 8 hours per day. All right, so this is perfect, of course, because he's got a cistern and he can pump water up and basically fill up that cistern as opposed to trying to have constant back pressure on a system in the home, which is how more typical well pumps are set up. Now, Jeff, I would say that I wouldn't consider this a cost savings because, you know, just to pay for the panels and the mounts alone, you could run your pump for several years and never recoup that cost. So maybe with the fact that it's also a great prep, you have some cut in cost for power, but it's not going to be a ton. As far as the 8 hours a day, most likely your pump is only running for about an hour or two per day, if that. And you can check that by taking a clamp meter. So you can get a meter that clamps on as an amp clamp around the power lines out to the pump. And I'll provide a link for one of those so you can get that. But you're going to monitor the wattage use for the day. So it'll give you a watt hour rating. And you can basically clamp it on at the beginning of the day, take it off after 24 hours, and look at what your watt hour rating is. So now you take the watt hours and you divide it by the number of, or what your running watts for your pump is, and that will give you the number of hours that your pump ran during that day. Keep in mind your pump is likely a 240 volt, and so you're either going to need to clamp onto either side of the split phase or double the number of watt hours that it says it's produced or used. I'll provide links for those as well as an Emporia whole home smart monitor, which is awesome if you're trying to go off grid or maybe you're trying to do a critical load system. The Emporia system allows you to clamp onto 16 different circuits and watch them and monitor them and get an idea of what your actual usage is. It also has clamps that clamp onto the incoming power to the home. So you can get a really good idea of what your consistent usage is before you think about going solar, and so then you can calculate a system much easier and more accurately. And of course, this would work well for the pump system if you want to go that route, but the general amp clamp monitor is about $20 to $30, whereas the Emporia whole home system is, I think, about $220. All right, so my experience with one of these systems is I installed one in a 400-foot well, so very similar to the one you're dealing with, Jeff. And what it does is with about six 400-watt panels, which means I've technically over-paneled for the system, we can pump water up to a tank at a much higher elevation, and that tank holds the water and creates enough pressure to distribute water throughout the farm to several watering stations for cattle on this remote property. One of the fun parts of this design, though, is that when the tank is all the way full, there's a pond on property that gets low during dry seasons. And so what we've done is once the tank is all the way full, the pump just keeps running and it actually overflows from the tank into the pond and makes the pond effectively a spring-fed pond. And now we've only done that with the knowledge that the well is incredibly more capable than what we're already pulling out of it. So we're not pulling more water out than the well can keep up with, and it's been tested for a much higher volume than what we're pulling. So with all of that, the other couple of links I'm going to include here are one for the well pump that I recommend from Backwoods Solar. They make an awesome well pump at a really decent price comparatively. The only other thing on the market, which is, in my opinion, almost identical, but about four or five times the cost, is a Grandfoss. So I highly recommend their pumps, and they've had some of these pumps up and running for well over a decade, I believe now, with very little to any problems. And I'm also going to include a link to a very simple, it's called a kilowatt meter, and this is just something you put in a receptacle and you can plug in whatever else you want to see what your energy use is. And these can be really useful for finding, say, freezers or refrigerators that are going bad or other devices, just to see what you're actually using so that you can reduce your energy usage. All right. With that being said, I think that answers Jeff's question. And if people have additional thoughts, or if you've got a system like this where you want some advice or help or consulting, that's the kind of thing I do. I really love these kind of technically challenging and interesting questions. And so if you've got questions, send them in to Jack. If you've got something that I can help you with on a more individual, your own property kind of situation, I'd love to help you out with that as well. You can find my contact information at thehomesteadconsultant.com. And if you haven't looked at my YouTube channel yet, you should. I've got a lot of this kind of interesting technical build out videos and things on my YouTube page. So if you go to youtube.com, just look up The Homestead Consultant. You'll find me. I'd love a subscription and for you to drop by and give me some comments and tell me what you think of some of the projects I'm working on. So with that, thank you, everybody. We will talk to you next time. And until then, go get your hands dirty.
And I do have all of the things that Ryan mentioned, the clamp monitor, the energy monitor, the kilowatt, the well pump kit, linked in the show notes. If you look for his bullet, right below it, there's four sub-bullets with those links, so you can check that stuff out. Next up, Nicole Sauce will be talking about the incubation of duck eggs.
Howdy, TSP. Nicole Sauce here with an expert question from Tori, who wants to know, how in the world do you successfully incubate duck eggs? Tori, that's a great question. And after talking to you, I know that you've had some challenges with your duck eggs going into the incubator and not coming out with ducklings, which can be frustrating. So here's what I'm going to talk about. One, how to choose and handle the eggs. Two, incubator standards. Three, a little bit about your specific incubator. I don't know what incubator you have, so I mean that like anybody's specific incubator. And then what's worked for us better than any of that on the Holler Homestead. So first of all, let's talk about collecting eggs for incubation. If you're going to incubate duck eggs, depending on the kind of duck, you will have a different timeline. So I have khaki Campbells and I have Muscovies. My khaki eggs take 28 days. My Muscovy eggs take like 34 days. So just look at the breed that you have to figure that out, just so you're mentally there. Because if you have Muscovy eggs and you think they're going to hatch at 28 days, like everybody on the internet says it takes for eggs to hatch, you're going to be wrong and you're going to stop the process before the Muscovies come into this world. Choosing eggs, I like to choose the ones that are clean, because the ones that are all covered in mud end up not doing as well. I think having that mud on the egg interferes with the transfer of oxygen into the egg. So that's just something to keep in mind. Eggs are laid and they have a bloom on them. If that bloom gets impacted by dirt, then that can cause problems too. So you just want to find the cleanest eggs you have. You and I both know ducks are messy little critters. So what I do when I want to collect eggs is I make sure I have the freshest litter possible. And I do deep litter in my coop where they lay. And I just keep sprinkling more and more and more on every day. And I do it at a time of year where it's not flood levels in Tennessee. When you collect the eggs, you can keep them for like a week. So I'll collect a few every day and put them in an egg carton. And I'll put the pointy part of the egg down on one day. And then the next day when I collect eggs, I'll put the butt up and I will turn the ones over that are with the pointy side down with the butt down. So what you're doing there is at least once a day, carefully, not hurriedly, turning the egg. And this is important. Don't shake your eggs up. Don't treat them too harshly. You want to be gentle with the eggs. Once I have enough for the incubator, I pop them in my incubator. So now we're into the how to incubate your eggs standard part of the discussion. So what you want to have is about 99.5 degrees. And to be perfectly honest, if you're not exactly that half degree one way or the other, all that does is impact time. You're still going to get ducklings. It's not like a hair trigger on that. Your relative humidity should be at about 55%. And if you have an incubator with a turner, that's great because you just turn the turner on. And if you're doing it manually, you're needing to slowly turn them, you know, 2-3 times a day. So my advice, make sure you have an egg turner. And that's going to be for the first week. On day 8, you pop it up to 60% humidity. Now, if you can't do this, then you can just start at 60% humidity. It'll still work. And on day 7, day 8, I candle the eggs and see if there's development. And if there isn't development, I put those eggs off in a separate section of the incubator in case I'm not seeing it right. What you'll see is that like a vein has developed. You might see something moving in there. That's kind of cool when it happens. So I don't candle the eggs every day, though. Like, I'm very careful about how often I open the incubator. And to be perfectly frank, you could not candle them, and you'd be fine, too. They won't explode, usually, before the end. The only reason to remove the ones that have not kicked off is that if they build up gases, they can explode, and it smells really bad, like rotten eggs when that happens and gets all over the other eggs. So then for day 8 to 21, on a standard 28-day duck cycle, which is typical ducks, you'll keep it at that 99.5 degrees, 60% relative humidity. At day 21, you're going into lockdown, right? This means that you stop turning the eggs. You unplug your egg turner. You bump up that relative humidity to 70 to 80%. And then on day 26 through day 28, they may start pipping and hatching, and you can watch that. It's super fun to watch. You pump up that relative humidity even higher, above 75%, up into 90% is fine. The reason you're doing that is when they pip the eggs and the air gets in there, it'll dry out that inner membrane, and if it dries it out before they get out of the egg, then they get stuck in the egg and they die. So what they're doing when they pip and hatch is they're going through a process where the rest of the yolk absorbs into their body, and if that gets interrupted, they're not a viable chick. Like, if you get one that hatches, by the way, with some of the yolk still sticking out of it, if you keep it really humid, sometimes it will absorb it in, but I find the ones where that happens are too weak to bother with. So that's your, like, textbook incubation. And if you're doing Muscovies, then lockdown is on, you know, 7 days before 34 days, basically. So you just adjust accordingly, or go on the internet and look up Muscovy incubation things. Now, I said relative humidity, not the humidity setting on your incubator. And that's because different incubators work different ways. So based on your actual incubator, go look up what they say to do for humidity settings, because there is basically a thing called, I think it's called bulb humidity. So you'll be at 80% bulb humidity to achieve 55% humidity with the eggs. If you have a probe in there that's measuring the actual humidity, like a Yolink probe can do that, then you're going to do relative humidity. Okay, so that's just a thing to be aware of. Now, when you want to use your incubator, look up from your incubator what they say to do and follow those instructions. It's that simple. My incubator is the one Jack recommended, I don't know, 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And it comes with an egg turner, so it just, and it allows me to set up the humidity settings and the temperature setting and how many days until lockdown. I have found on mine that I just set it up at 60% relative humidity, and then I don't even do the change after the first week. And then I run it, you know, until lockdown, and then I bump up the humidity. The way I control the humidity is not a digital control. I have a control on the digital that says what the humidity should be, and then an alarm goes off if it goes out of the range. And the way I control it is by pouring water into a tray, and then that's getting heated up by the incubator itself, and it achieves humidity. So for me to be successful, I incubate inside my house in the mudroom, where the temperature is stable. If you are incubating outside and it's going through great ups and downs, you're less likely to, A, keep the 99.5% degrees, right? And you are less likely to keep your humidity fairly stable. So that's just another thing to think about. And if you incubate eggs inside your house, you will smell the incubating of the eggs. So if you have a basement or somewhere stable that's not in your house, you're going to be happier because it kind of stinks when they start hatching. Okay, so here's what we've done, though, to be successful at the Holler Homestead. Our ducks go broody, and we let them set the eggs, and we let them hatch the eggs, and we keep them protected. Once they're broody, we don't try to move them. We leave them where they are. I've done things like put fences around them to keep predators out, that sort of thing. And when the ducks hatch, the mom is still sort of in slow mode. We steal the babies and we brood them separate from the mom, because what we've found is if we let the mom brood them, we have a much higher die-off rate from other ducks or whatever that's in my particular property. Other people that have better protected properties don't have this issue. So you can do that, or you can set up a separate pen where you move the mom and the babies. She will throw a fit and try to bite you and all of those things. If it's a Muscovy, they have sharp nails. Be careful. We've been more successful with hatching that way than we are in the incubator, although we are also successful in the incubator. I just had one hatch out 14, and if I hadn't moved her and that last pipped egg, or two pipped eggs, at the end of the day, because I just didn't want her out all night, I would have probably gotten 15. So we got 13 hatched. We moved her, plus I noticed two eggs were eeping and pipped, and I moved them without changing which direction was up for them, very gently, put them under her, and one of them was successful and the other one wasn't. And I'm sure that's because I moved them and ticked her off and all of those things, and she sort of ignored them. Anyway, I hope this helps you incubate eggs. I think the biggest thing you should do is see how you can set up a situation to get non-muddy eggs in your duck area and then go from there. And if you have one go broody, it's a gift. Protect that bird like she's gold. All right, guys, I hope this helped you get enthusiastic about your homestead projects for the summer. And if you want to support what I'm doing, you can do it two ways. You can get some coffee over at hollowroast.com with your MSB discount. We've got great coffee that's roasted to over order at hollowroast.com. Also, if you want to hear more about homestead stuff and other building the life you choose sort of things, I have a podcast you can check out at livingfreeintennessee.com. Make it a great week.
Yeah, definitely start out with the cleanest, best eggs you can get. That would be one of, and it's easier said than done with ducks. I'll also say, like, I think a lot of people that have trouble incubating ducks, and we did as well, one of the reasons is you think you're doing everything the way you're supposed to, because you sort of are, but you're really not, and your humidity ends up slipping. And since most people that try to incubate ducks first incubate chickens, and chickens are very, and I mean very forgiving eggs to incubate. As many of you know, I used to, a long time ago, actually breed reptiles, specifically snakes, and a particular snake called an African house snake. I was kind of playing around with genetics, trying to create some new forms of them, new phenotypes. And, man, getting snake eggs to, you know, hold the right amount of humidity and all and get it, it's a lot of work. I don't know how the hell those, I mean, they don't take care of their eggs. I don't know how the hell they have such high hatch rates in nature, but I guess they just know the right place to pick at the right time. And of course, I'm talking about egg laying snakes here, not live bearers like garters or live bearers. So all I'm saying is I have a unique appreciation for how finicky it can be to hatch an egg. And I'm going to say that if you looked at, like, a snake egg on a thing being one of the more difficult eggs to properly incubate and hatch, and a chicken egg being on the spectrum, like, to the left about as easy as it'll get, you know, with quail eggs kind of right in there with a chicken, the duck's somewhere about halfway to three-quarters toward the snake egg in getting everything right. And the biggest thing is I would err toward a little more humidity than you should have, then a little bit less than you should have. That's been my experience. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and move on and answer the question, what is Michael Saylor selling with all these different securities, stocks, etc.? And Jesse Markowitz will talk about that.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz from yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. Recently, I've gotten a number of questions about Strategy, Michael Saylor's company, and all these ticker symbols people keep seeing. MSTR, STRC, STRK, STRD, STRF. Mostly the questions boil down to, what are these products? And why this instead of just buying Bitcoin? One quick aside. This is not investment advice. I'm not here to tell you what to buy. My goal is to help you understand what they are, what they're not, and where the risks are. So first, Strategy's model is straightforward. They raise money from investors. They use much of that money to buy Bitcoin. Then they use all that Bitcoin on their balance sheet to raise more money and buy more Bitcoin. The result of this is they are one of the largest holders of Bitcoin in the world. They started buying Bitcoin back in 2020, and the last time I checked, their website, May 2026, they reported 843,738 Bitcoin, a little over 4% of all the Bitcoin that will ever exist. So the first way they raise money is common shares, MSTR. If you buy MSTR, you're buying shares of Strategy, the company. There's no particular dividend, no guaranteed income, no special protections, and you're at the bottom of the stack to get paid if things go badly. But you also get the most upside if Bitcoin does well. So this is basically a leverage bet on Bitcoin and Strategy's ability to keep accumulating more Bitcoin per share. If Bitcoin goes up, MSTR will go up even more. But if it goes down, MSTR can suffer even more. So if all you want is a financial product that tracks the price of Bitcoin inside a brokerage account, a Bitcoin ETF is a cleaner tool. But if you want that extra leverage, that extra volatility there, MSTR is pretty good. Now, some people are looking for less volatility than Bitcoin, not more. Frequently, those folks would also like some sort of cash payout, some dividend. They'd like to earn a return on some of their money. So for these investors, Strategy offers preferred stocks. These are the other ticker symbols I mentioned before. Each of them have slightly different rules to target different audiences. Some have slightly higher risk, some have higher payouts, some pay out fixed dividends, some are variable, some of the dividends have catch-up provisions, they're cumulative, and some can even be converted into common stock under certain conditions. The best known of these is STRC. That's what one Strategy calls Stretch. Stretch is particularly interesting because Strategy designed it to act like a high-yield cash management product. It pays monthly dividends. They're actually talking right now about converting it to being paid twice a month. And Strategy can adjust the dividend rate to try to keep the market price trading close to $100. As of May 2026, Strategy listed Stretch is paying 11.5% annual dividend. So it may feel like a bank account where your principal stays stable and you get 11.5%. But it's not like a federally insured bank account. You have Bitcoin risk and company risk. If Bitcoin falls hard enough or if Strategy itself gets into trouble, you could lose all of your money there, including the principal. Now, if Strategy can raise money at 11%, 10%, 8%, or even less, then use that money to buy Bitcoin that appreciates far more than that over time. The model works beautifully. They pay investors their yield. Strategy keeps the additional upside from the Bitcoin. If Bitcoin is flat or if it drops hard and stays down, Strategy's whole model could be in trouble. A quick side note here. Michael Saylor is famous for saying, never sell your Bitcoin. But at some point, Strategy may actually sell some Bitcoin. The fear is, if Strategy sells some Bitcoin, folks may think that's a sign of weakness, and so Bitcoin might go down. Folks might sell their Strategy products, and it might become a downward spiral. But realistically, even if there is no weakness, it might make sense. Strategy CEO mentioned recently there are tax benefits for selling higher cost basis Bitcoin and capturing unrealized losses. On Strategy's Q1 2026 earnings call, Saylor said, "We will probably sell some Bitcoin to fund a dividend just to inoculate the market, just to send the message that we did it." For most people listening to the show, I still think the foundation is learning Bitcoin and saving some portion of your wealth in a wallet you control. That is where you learn the power and responsibility of being your own bank. But different people have different situations. If your financial needs and comfort level match one of Strategy's products, it may make sense for you. Just understand what you're buying. The preparedness lesson here is the old one, look before you leap. Understand what you're buying, what the risks and benefits are. Bitcoin in self-custody is one thing. A Bitcoin ETF is another. MSTR is another. Stretch and the other preferred shares are something else again. They all give you some kind of Bitcoin exposure, but they're not the same tool and they're not for the same job. This has been Jesse Markowitz with YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. One last thing. I'm also a certified professional ski instructor, and I'm investigating organizing a survival podcast ski trip for late spring 2027. If you think you might be interested or just want more information, please reach out to me at Jesse@YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Keep the questions coming. I look forward to answering more of them soon.
I think one of the reasons that Saylor gets hate, well, there's a lot of reasons. One is because influencers want attention, and screaming and shouting at a big name is one way to garner their attention. But I think there are a lot of people that they they criticize a lot of what they don't understand because they're coming from a myopic viewpoint. And what I mean is, but most of the really big names in Bitcoin have been in it for a while, and they have a lot of money in Bitcoin. In fact, many of them have almost all their wealth in Bitcoin, and so it is already invested. And that person doesn't really understand the concept of there's actually people with lots of money that's not in Bitcoin, and it's not, maybe it's not even, there's people with cash, right? There's people with liquid capital who are looking for places to put it. Well, I would put it in Bitcoin. What if you want cash flow? What if you want cash flow? Where are you going to put it now? Do you see what I'm saying? Like, cash flow matters. So some of these investment vehicles that sellers put together, you know, are paying quarterly dividends in the neighborhood of 10%. So a 10% dividend on, let's say, $1 million, right, is $100,000, which is roughly $25,000 a quarter. So there's people that have more than $1 million, they have lots of investments, and they would like some cash flow without devaluing their underlying investment. So something that produces a 10% dividend looks very attractive to that person. So you get I call them the autistic, over-the-top autistic maxis, right? He said he sell Bitcoin. Self-custody is the only way. Like, just shut up. That person has, and all sailors doing is taking the approach of, this is the most amazing, hard money known to man, and I'm holding, like, I'm holding 4% of all of it that exists in the world. And if all I do is hold it, it doesn't have any cash flow. So what he did is put together different ways to derive cash flow from it so that you can get more out of having it than just saying, I have a bunch of money. Because here's the deal. Most of these people, I would never go put my money in Strike or Strike or Stretch. You probably, because you can't. Probably because, like me, you have a lot of money in Bitcoin, and you know that the first thing that's going to happen is I'm going to pay somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 to 40% capital gains total burden on that shit when I sell it. So I have to sell my Bitcoin to move it into Strike. I'm not doing it. I don't want to do that. But the person that has other forms of liquid capital might, and the person that is investing, and they're investing even in the long term, may want to allocate some of their investments into a high.
Hey, TSP, today I'm going to answer a couple investing questions. For time's sake, I'm going to abbreviate the questions, and then I'm also going to add a little bit of, maybe life lesson into these questions so that it's applicable even if, you know, you're not interested in investing in the stock market. Okay, first question comes from Rich. He's asking about the upcoming SpaceX IPO and whether he should try and get in initially or whether he should wait. Okay, my recommendation, and this is just generally for all IPOs, is that you're probably better off waiting. And I say that for two reasons. Well, really one reason overall, and that's that these IPOs are heavily marketed. So although I'm going to give you two reasons, it really comes down to, because of this heavily marketing and excitement that Wall Street drums up to launch these IPOs, in most cases, not all cases, but in my opinion, most cases, you're probably overpaying, right? Think of an auction where you've got a really good auctioneer and he's hyping a particular item. He can talk that price up well in excess of the value of the actual product. And remember, when it comes to stocks, there's no bad or good stocks. There's simply bad or good stock prices. So it all comes down to what you pay. Now, the other item that goes along with the hyped up nature of the IPOs, and the reason you can generally or oftentimes buy in at a lower price if you wait, there's no price discovery on the initial IPO. Wall Street and analysts and talking heads are creating the momentum and the excitement, and they're telling you what the stock is likely worth or what it should be priced at. But because it's never publicly traded before, And because private companies have much more opaque and less disclosure than publicly traded companies, you really don't have any idea of what that stock is really worth, other than what the CEO and Wall Street analysts and the guys at Goldman Sachs or whoever are telling you it's worth. And all these people are compensated in one way or another on getting the highest price to launch that stock. So if you wait, say 3 months, 6 months, maybe 12 months, you no longer have to rely simply on a self-interested party telling you what the stock is worth, but through the mechanism of price discovery within the stock market, the market itself will eventually tell you what they think the fair price of the stock is. So by waiting, it doesn't guarantee that you're going to get a lower price, but in my opinion, it does guarantee that because of the price discovery mechanism of the market, that you're going to have a better idea of whether you're paying a fair price or not. Now, again, in my opinion, the reason I would wait is because after about 6 months or so, the people that are locked up and prohibited from initially selling, the insiders, they can sell their shares. And guess what they do? In most cases, they do sell them. And when they do sell them, that puts more stock on the market, and generally the price goes down. That's why, in most cases, or many cases, you can get an overpriced, hyped-up IPO much cheaper if you wait 6 months or more. As a side note, this is more of a life lesson. Everybody wants to get in SpaceX right now. I hear a lot of questions from my podcast listeners about it, but you know what virtually no one ever asked me about? And that's a satellite company named Globalstar. Its ticker symbol is GSAT, G-S-A-T. Like the name implies, it's in the satellite business. It's in the space business. It's been a publicly traded company for, I don't know, probably at least 25 years or more. And if you want to get into a space type oriented company, you haven't had to wait on SpaceX to become available, nor did you have to be some kind of an insider or an accredited investor to buy into a pre-IPO company like SpaceX. You could have simply invested in GSAT. Over the last 5 years, they're up 254%. Over the last year, the last 12 months, they're up over 330%. And just in the last 6 months, they're up over 45%. Now, a lot of this recent price appreciation has to do with the fact that Amazon is trying to acquire them. But the bottom line here, to paraphrase what Donald Rumsfeld once said about going to war, you know, when it comes to the stock market, you don't trade the stock market you want, you trade the stock market you have. And so rather than looking for the grass being greener and trying to get on things that Wall Street is hyping and that there's artificial scarcity of because it's not available to you, I would encourage you to focus on what's right in front of you. And again, that's a life lesson that you can take beyond the stock market. Now, second question comes from Bill. And to abridge his question, he's basically saying, hey, what about people that either don't have time or don't have the inclination or don't have the desire to study or learn about the market and they want to invest? You know, should they be investing in regular old index funds or actively managed funds? Now, actively managed funds are supposedly supposed to outperform the market. And because of that, you pay a much more or a larger management fee than you would in the index funds. Now, personally, I'm not a fan of actively managed funds for pretty much the reason that Bill mentions in his email. These actively managed funds charge a lot more and they don't necessarily beat the market consistently. So you have to constantly study and keep up on which funds are doing the best. In most cases, you end up chasing performance because instead of sticking with one particular style of investing, you're always trying to, again, look for the grass being greener and going with the guy that performed the best over the last 6 months or the, you know, last 12 months. And then his method doesn't work as much. And so then you switch to the next guy. And if you're going to spend that much time studying the market, well, maybe you should just be picking your own stocks to begin with. So broadly speaking, yes, I'm a huge fan of investing in low-cost index funds, but not for the typical reason you hear on Wall Street, because I'll tell you, the managed, non-managed argument is really a myth. All funds are managed. It's just a matter of how much you're paying for that management. And the reason I say that, and again, this is a life lesson here, an indexed fund isn't just some random walk in Wall Street where you arbitrarily are investing in stocks. I mean, the S&P 500 includes 500 stocks for a reason. They're not from one particular sector or industry in the market. That's the whole point of them. The S&P 500 is made up of both mega and large and some mid-cap and some small stocks that are trying to diversify and give you a quality representation of the market. So someone somewhere is picking those 500 stocks, right? They have 10,000 to choose from, but there are only 500 stocks in the S&P 500. So therefore, it is managed. Likewise, there are thousands of small cap stocks. Whether you're looking at the Russell 2000 or the small cap 600, someone, somewhere, some committee is selecting those particular stocks from a universe of 10,000 stocks. And the reason that index investing works isn't because you're investing in a quote index or because you're investing in the total market. It's because these indexes are designed to focus on the winners, right? And this is the life lesson. The way you get into an index is to be consistently growing in the category that that particular index invests in. So every month or every quarter, they throw out the losers and they bring in new winners. That's the magic of index investing. It's not the just dollar cost averaging into the market willy-nilly. It's investing in appreciating assets. So it really does come down to stock picking. Again, that's why personally, I primarily invest in stocks because I want to pick those stocks rather than having a committee pick them for me. But getting back to the life lesson, don't swim upstream in your life. Be selective in what you do. If you're constantly hitting a dead end in your career, right, maybe you need to get a new career. If you're hanging around negative, unachieving people, maybe you need some new friends. If you're planting a garden and your squash never produces a good crop, well, you know, maybe you should stop growing squash and grow something else. Hey, in any case, I just want to close on this life lesson that markets adjust and people adapt. That parallels the spirit of the military where we talk about improvise, adapt, and overcome. Life is always going to throw you challenges and you can complain about it. You can sit back and not do anything, but the winners will find a way to get to the objective that they want. Hey, in any case, as always, thanks for the questions. Until next time, this is John Pugliano from Investable Wealth and the Wealthsteading Podcast.
I will tell you this on the IPO thing. If you go back and look at prior IPOs and some like the most rock star stocks of the modern era, okay, the Mag 7 and others, generally you'll find this pattern. You might be able to find that during the IPO, like the insiders that were at the sole front of the line that got it for pennies on the dollar did well. But the vast majority of people who invested in the IPO, and you know this is the day that all of the company owners get rich. It's when they become billionaires overnight and the bells ring and the champagne flows and all. And that's because of the bidding war that John talked about. As the shares are released, it costs more and more and more. And the bigger that number is, the better it is for the firm that's effectively selling off its equity. Understand that's what an IPO is. It's a company selling part of itself to outside investors. They're just generally so diluted individually that they don't really have a say in what happens in the company. That's kind of where it's like a win-win for them. They get all this money, they sell part of their equity, but they maintain control of the operations, right? That's what an IPO actually is. You got it? Okay, so if you go look that up, what you're going to find is you find the average price paid by an average street-level investor for the IPO. Look at the stock price in 6 months. It's almost inevitable that you could have got it then for less. Think of it like, you know, when a special new phone comes out, people stand in line overnight. Or like, you know, Chevy says we're releasing the limited edition blah 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 Camaro or whatever, and everybody fights for it, the original Raptors or whatever, and then, you know, you wait 6 months and anybody that wants to can buy one for a regular price. That's the same type of philosophy there. That's what John was getting at. Well, next up, let's before we have my segment today, it's going to kind of get in a little bit of psychology. Let's hear some stuff on cooking for guests. In this case, what can we do to create an experience at a dinner party that will just blow away our guests and our family?
Is this a survival topic?
No, it's a lifestyle design topic. That's what we do here. Anyway, let's hear from Chef Ken Daniels.
Hello all, Chef Ken here. Today's question comes from Rich, who's planning a dinner party for four towards the end of June and wants one meal that really knocks the socks off his guest. He mentioned dry aging steaks, some whiskey pairings, homemade cherries, wedge salad, hollandaise. And honestly, I love this kind of question because it tells me somebody isn't just trying to feed people. They're really trying to make a memorable night. What people actually remember is an atmosphere, right? So they remember warmth. They remember pacing. They remember whether the host looked calm through the whole process and they actually got to sit down and enjoy the evening. So instead of asking, what's the fanciest thing I can cook? I think the better question is, what can I execute confidently that feels elevated, memorable, and relaxed? That changes everything. Now, late June is a beautiful time to cook because you can balance richness with brightness. You can use smoke and char without making things feel too heavy. And you can lean into herbs and stone fruit, whiskey, grilled vegetables, chilled salads, all the things that make summer dinners feel alive. And honestly, I think your instincts are already very good. You mentioned the prosciutto with melon idea that I have on my website. It's timeless, right? It's salty, it's sweet, it's cold, it's savory. But if you want alternatives in that same spirit, there are some beautiful directions that you could go. One of my favorites this time of year is a charred peach with burrata. Grilled peaches pick up the smoke and bitterness while the burrata cools everything back down. Little drizzle of olive oil, basil, little salt flakes, kosher salt. It feels elegant without being too hard. Or elevate even beyond, maybe roast some bone marrow with some grilled bread, some parsley if you want the evening to feel like more rich. That immediately changes the tone of the table in the best way. And if you want to get even more adventurous, beef tartare. Now, Jack was with me about a year or so ago when I pulled beef directly off a bull and made some beef tartare on site. It's one of my favorite go-to dishes. Now, I know that tartare scares people because they think it belongs only in expensive restaurants and you're eating raw beef. It's nothing to be fearful, right? Good tartare is simply good because the beef is treated with respect. It's hand cut. It's cold. It's brightened with some capers, shallots, mustard. Definitely an egg yolk. I cannot tell you enough how much the egg yolk makes this elevated beyond reason. It creates a moment where guests stop casually eating and then they just, man, they pay attention when you bring out beef tartare. But here's the key. You really don't need all those things, right? One memorable opener is enough. So pick one and go with it. It's that simple. All right. Now, Rich mentioning dry aging beef. And honestly, if you've never done it, this could be a really fantastic excuse to try it. 30-day dry age ribeye or strip loin can absolutely become the centerpiece of the meal. I recommend using larger cuts. You will have a lot of moisture reduction, and you will also have some trimming that you'll need to do. But this does, it deepens the flavor, it concentrates moisture, it develops this crust that naturally, when seared, it is like one of the best flavors you'll ever have. And if you go that route, yes, I would use the umai bags for your first run. Traditional open air aging at home has a lot of variables, right? You open up the fridge and the temperature rises, the humidity is all over the place. Yeah, these bags simplify the process enough that you can focus on the execution instead of wondering whether your refrigerator has become a damn science project, right? And you don't even have to go beef. So a beautiful tomahawk pork chop can be just as memorable. I just got back from Hawaii. Pork was one of the best dishes I had there, and honestly more surprising for your guests because most people had never really had cooked pork properly, right? Slight red in the center, a deep crust, rendered fat, maybe kissed with some smoke from the grill or smoker, and suddenly the pork chop is, instead of this other option, it becomes this huge, memorable piece of the dinner. I'd even recommend going to your processors. We're a little behind in the deer season, right? But a lot of these yahoos haven't picked up some of the deers that they process and paid for, and these guys are looking for cooler space. They would kind of probably kindly get rid of some of that venison that's sitting there. So don't think that venison is out of the picture since you're just a little outside of season. The goal here is not to be impressive through cost. It's confidence through your execution. Now, sides of where you can quietly elevate this whole experience, creamy polenta instead of mashed potatoes, slowly cooked with some butter and Parmesan. It becomes rich without being too heavy. Let's lean on mushrooms as usual. Charred maitake mushrooms is another great way to elevate it. Listen back to some of our segments. We've talked about mushrooms before. I think that could be a good option for you. And then you need something kind of fresh to wake up the palate, right? So I like using a wilted arugula salad. I basically will use warm bacon drippings with a little bit of like lemon or sherry vinegar. So basically I take the arugula, I pour over the warm or hot bacon grease on top. It wilts it, add a little bit of lemon sherry to it, a little salt, and it definitely like brightens the flavor of all these rich foods. It's got this peppery kind of green against the fatty meat and the creamy starch. It just works, right? So let's talk whiskey, because that's what you mentioned, and I definitely want to talk about that. Do not feel pressure to create some giant allocated whiskey showcase. Nobody enjoys a dinner where the host, or even me, spends 20 minutes talking about some secondary bourbon market while the food gets cold, right? That's not the time for this. And there's no reason that you need to be going out and buying Blanton's. That's not the point of this. Let's keep it simple. So for me, I start with a great old fashioned. If you want to make homemade sherries like we discussed, take the extra mile and do it, man. It's fun to experiment, and these are the friends that you're sharing this with. You can laugh about things that you make a mistake on, so just go for it. Dried orange garnishes, you damn better believe it. I'm going to throw some orange peels or orange slices into my dehydrator. It's a really cool technique, and it actually builds out a lot of different flavors that you're not normally getting with fresh oranges. Good ice is always important. And then just let everything happen on its own, right? If you need to know how to make this cocktail, there's a million of them on YouTube University. Please go. If you need help, you can always reach out to me too. Later that evening, after the dinner settles, conversation's slow, that's when you bring in something more like intense, right? So my current go-to right now are pre-prohibition style rye like Leopold Brothers Three Chambers, or the better cost-effective item, Old Potrero. Both of these use a different style of processing the rye grain, and it's much richer, it's less spicy. These work beautifully because they're grain forward, earthy, herbal, slightly rustic in the best way. They're leathery and rich, and they go well with a ton of desserts. Don't think that you're getting like these spicy Kentucky style ryes that you're used to. These are in a whole other category of whiskeys, and they're flying under most radars because people are still hunting after all those dang allocations. Dessert, if you didn't use the grilled peach and burrata before, I'd sit out on the patio, grill these peaches while enjoying my whiskey, add a dollop of cream or burrata on top, drizzle with a little honey, even a little pistachio on top adds a little bit of texture. You could do heavier desserts like chocolate, but it's summertime, man. Keep it light. Another banger, fresh watermelon cubed up with some cubed up feta cheese and mint. Cool, simple, refreshing. The most important part, you are being intentional and deliberate with whatever choice you make. That's cooking with love, and whomever you're cooking for will feel this. Make sure you spend time with them during that evening and not be overwhelmed in the kitchen. Honestly, this is when hiring a local chef to do the heavy lifting for you can be beneficial. This lets you enjoy your evening too. Rich, I'm always available to you in whatever capacity you need during the next month or so if you have any questions. That goes for everyone in the TSP community. info@bloodsugarchef.com. That is my email, info@bloodsugarchef.com. And I want to thank everybody who's been emailing me. I hope these ideas help. I recommend reaching out to me or jumping on YouTube for some in-depth explanations. This dinner will go very well, and these guests are very lucky you're putting in such effort. Your kind words about my segment are appreciated, Rich. Thank you so much. And until next time, this is Ken, your blood sugar chef. Cheers.
So great stuff from Ken. I'm not going to have any add-on to it because this is going to be a longer episode because I put seven experts in it instead of the six, which is normal. There were some people that we hadn't heard from for a while and some people that got me some last-minute stuff I asked for because I didn't know if I was going to have enough and I didn't want to leave them feel like they were hanging or whatever. So I'm not going to add to Ken's stuff, even though I want to because I love talking about food. We're going to talk today, though, about why we focus on problems we have no influence over versus the problems that are directly in our circle of control, even sometimes when those two things are related. And here's a fundamental reality about human beings. We are more like the person that was walking around on this planet 100,000, 50,000, 10,000, 5,000 years ago than we care to admit and that we care to think of ourselves as. Yes, we have smartphones and TV sets and cars, and we have lifestyles that a person even a few hundred years ago couldn't dream of. We have lifestyles that are better than royalty from a few hundred years ago and back. For the average middle-class person, in fact, so far above the royalty of the time. We don't have the power, but the lifestyle, like what we're able to eat, what we're able to get our hands on, if you think about like kings, they had slaves. Or servants or whatever. But how many people in human labor does it take to do the work of the internal combustion engine in your car? That's effectively contributing towards your lifestyle how many slaves you own or servants you have. When you think of it that way, you realize how great our lives are today. And it insulates us a lot from who we really are. From a psychological standpoint. So I will tell you that human beings for most of our existence existed in small bands, and being able to function within your band was a survival requirement. And if you think I'm talking about walking across the plains with 12 other humanoids at the dawn of mankind, yeah, but not only that, I'm talking about even just 100 years ago. If you just go back before everybody in the country had a TV set and a radio and the internet, and even at the time we had TV and radio, like I'm going to tell you that the bonds were a lot tighter in social groups when I was a kid in high school, and I know that's all the way back in the 1900s and 80s, right? The late part of the last century, some as the arrogant Gen Zers are throwing at us. And you know what? I'm not picking on Gen Z for that one. Well played. Well played, young people. Well played, right? I would have done it, right? If I would have been, 25 years old in 1925, I would have done the same thing to somebody born in 1872. Okay, absolutely, I would have. So, yeah, you get to do that. But what I'm saying is, I just think back to when I grew up, and finding a kind of a clique, if you want to call it that, your own tribe of people that you spent time with in the real world was really important. And when you had people in that group who you didn't necessarily get along with, but the other people in the group did, you tolerated them. And if they didn't like you, they tolerated you if the rest of the group. See how that works? And it's because we're hardwired in our evolution from the very beginning to have this cohesion. And then what happens is if you put something in our orbit that negates the need for us to physically do it and gives us crutches to hold us up, like social media, okay, like email, like being able to get any information from anybody at any time we want at all on demand, whether it's 3 in the afternoon or 3 in the morning, doesn't matter. The need for it may go away, but the evolutionary artifact in our hearts and minds and souls does not. And so because of all this, when something happened, if you go back to prehistory, you go back to the time when humans really were like these hunter-gatherer groups, and one group saw another, and staying cohesive and sticking together during that time to fight the other band off or scare them away was so important. We evolutionary are driven by this. And when we are part of a group, shouting down something, yelling at something, convincing ourselves we chased away the bad guys like a monkey, like a gorilla banging on his chest like King Kong, we get a dopamine hit. It feels good. The other thing it does is when the thing that we're rallying together with our fake tribe that's built around an algorithm and we're shouting a thing down, we can shout at a thing that doesn't have any, our shouting had no impact whatsoever, but our internal dialogue and our mind and our endorphin mix, it still hits like we did chase away the lion. Right? We were out with a little group. We got our couple kids with us. That's who the lion really wants, to grab the kid and run off in the woods and eat him. And we all yell and scream and shout, hold our sticks in the air and yell and look really big, start stomping around. And the lion, who could kill any one of us, looks at all of us and goes, fuck, I don't want this. Bares his teeth, shows his claws, and hauls ass. And we all cheer, yeah! We get that same dopamine hit. So that's the first thing. It feels good, so we're wired to do it, but that's something else. When we all get together and chase away the fake lion, or we think we chased away the real lion because we all said, I support blah blah, or I oppose blah blah, and the thing you support or oppose doesn't give a metric fucking square millimeter of a fraction of that about what you supported or opposed, you had no impact on, we get the same dopamine hit. And you know when we get really mad? When somebody points it out and says, hey, that you didn't do anything. We get more mad at them than the opposing tribe says, no, we scared it away, or that's our monster. We love that monster. You have to let that monster alone. Like, we get upset at that tribe, but the people that say, I'm not going to do this stupid shit. I'm not going to get in your monkey shit throwing contest. I'm going to step. Now we get really, really, really mad because they're messing up our ability to convince ourselves that we did something because we know in our hearts we did nothing. And that, when you point that out to people, you can't do it that direct, but when you really put the pressure on in those discussions, you know, you get, at least my children will know that I stood for something. Really? How? Are you going to tell them? Do you think they're going to believe you? You stood for something? What does that mean? You stood for something? What did you stand for? What did you do? What did it matter? Other than in your mind, and in the minds of your fellow virtual you see what I'm talking about here? We get into this mindset because as long as we are focused on things we literally can't change, we are not required to focus on things that we can change that always require work. And there's so many examples of that. Right now, data centers are a perfect example of that. They're going to surveil us. They're going to surveil you. Yes. The data centers. The data center is a tool. You are making the same argument that the left makes about guns. This person who was crazy, a dude dressed like a woman that the left says really can be a woman by putting a dress on and simply saying magic words, I am a woman, took her crazy ass, whatever it is, into a school and shot other children with it. And so that means we need to get rid of guns. And you go, that's stupid. That's ridiculous. Why would we do that? I mean, that's one person doing an evil thing with a gun. A gun is a tool. The gun does what it goes where you take it. It shoots where you point it. It doesn't shoot when you don't pull the trigger. You know, I mean, this is dumb. Why are you making that argument? And of course, they're making the argument because they just don't want the gun. There's so much shit like that. But in this case, you're arguing against something you're not going to stop. But the more dangerous thing with the data center example is Tammy and Susie and Billy and Frankie all decide in bumfuck Iowa they don't want a dirty, nasty data center near their home, so they go to the town council and fight the data center. Now, the data center either gets built in their town or outside their town or whatever, it doesn't. But somewhere that data center is going to get built. And then they say, well, we did it because it uses all the water. You say, well, actually, all the new data centers are using recirculatory evaporative cooling, and they are actually using very little water once they initially fill up. They're recycling the water over and over. Of the water they use for cooling, only about 5% cycles through or is lost. Well, you're using all the electricity, and then you point out that that's nonsense, that everybody draws electricity from the same place, and we don't have any places where people just don't have power because data centers. In fact, we've needed to build more power capacity for a long time, and this is actually making that happen, which is a good thing, and the more energy we have, the more free our society is. So then they move on. But they're going to surveil us. Okay, and here's the thing. So then what happens is Tammy and Susie and Bobby and Billy all think by fighting the data center in bumfuck Iowa, they're fighting surveillance. Surveillance is one thing. Data centers are another. Just because one thing can be used to do a thing doesn't make it the thing. Let me tell you something about your government. Your government has many, many giant buildings already. They already exist.
They already have electricity to them. And if the federal government wants more power to a building, it's going to get it. The federal government doesn't need to build these new data centers. And I'm not saying they won't use any of them. I'm just saying they don't need to. So if the plan really is build all the data centers and surveil everybody like Black Mirror, if you delude yourself into thinking you're fighting surveillance by fighting the data center in bumfuck Iowa or bumfuck Pennsylvania or bumfuck Texas, it doesn't matter where, then you're fighting the thing that isn't the thing that you really care about, but you feel like you are. You get the dopamine hit, and while you're busy fighting you're tilting at windmills, they're actually building the thing. The surveillance you're worried about exists. It exists. You better start learning to deal with it. But instead, you're being pointed at a thing that they... do you not understand how manipulated this is? Do you not think the people that you think you're fighting are actually the people that created the resistance to the thing that you think you're fighting? Do you not understand? How many of you have still not read the Illuminatus trilogy? You need to. You need to start understanding the pattern going on here. Have you noticed that no one has said a word about climate change for about 2 years in any meaningful way anymore? That just the guy kind of went away? Who do you think is behind that? Same people behind this. It's a new thing for you to get mad about. As long as you're mad about the wrong thing, they can do whatever they want with the thing that is the right thing for them to get what they want, which is what you really don't want. But you're hardwired for this. You're hardwired to join in on these false causes because it satisfies two innate psychological needs. One, the need to be part of a tribe that yells at, shouts something down, and scares it away. And two, the internal desire to avoid the real work that matters. Every second you spend worrying about, you think you're going to support, like, do you support this? I'm so sorry. I'm tired of you people with that. But do you support this? Why the fuck does that even matter? What does that mean? What does support mean? There's charities I support, and I support them because I write a fucking check, and I send it, and that check goes to further the mission of the charity. Your emotion about a headline on a screen is neither support or opposition to anything. Support and opposition must be meaningful, or they don't exist. So if you want to stop a data center in your town, go ahead. I don't care. I don't care. What I care about is this nonsensical meme going around that, like, we have to stop all the data centers or they're going to surveil us. Because it's basically saying, if we stop all of these things, they won't do the thing that they're already doing and already building the infrastructure to do that they're going to finish. I don't care what you think about it. I care how you think about it. And I care that so many people are out spouting this shit out of my own community that I spent 18 years building, by the way. They have no idea what they're actually upset about. They have no knowledge at all. They are fundamentally, and I mean this not in an insulting way, fundamentally ignorant to the subject. What is a data center? What is a data center? A data center is a building with a bunch of compute in it. And all the systems necessary to run and access memory and allow data to come in and data to go out and for other computers to work in other locations. The way I know that is I used to design and fucking oversee them being built in the late 1990s. I didn't physically do the building. I designed and sold and spec'd a data center for Mark Cuban that was part of Broadcast.com in 1990-freaking-8. That's a data center. Well, these are different data centers. Yes, they have more advanced computers in them, and they exist for a different reason. They're still just a big building full of computers and, by the way, fire suppression systems. That's a really important component to a data center. But here's the thing. I don't care what you think about them. They're going to be built. You're not going to stop it. You might stop one in bumfuck Sheboyganville, Iowa. Sure. But you haven't done anything. But your mind will tell you you had. All of you will get together and think that your magical support to stop data centers, your magical opposition, and all your combined energy flow from X and Facebook made it go away. They just moved it a couple freaking miles down the road. It's nonsense. And it's not going to stop, and you're not going to get rid of it, and the genie's out of the bottle. You better learn to deal with it. What I'm telling you, and I've been teaching you this for 18 years, he's different. No, I'm the same, and that's what's bothering you. The consistency is annoying. Okay? Right? The most important thing to understand here is way more important what is and what will be than what you wish was and what you think should be. And when we sit around hoping that if we just all collectively, I don't know, navel gaze on social media, all the bad things in the world will stop, and we act as if the one person who disagrees with us, because he has a podcast, if he would just, it's his fault. It's his fault. It's his, I hope they build one in your backyard, Jack. Well, I don't think they will. It's not really a good location. But there is a pretty big empty spot on Highway 199, about 2 miles from my house. If they build one there, I don't know if my neighbors will oppose it or not. I don't know if they'll go to the local town council or not. But I didn't go to the local town council for fucking anything. I've been here 14 years, 13 years, something like that. Why would I all of a sudden, oh, this one's different? No, I don't care. It's a building with computers in it. Where do they build it there? Or they build it somewhere else, they're going to build it. And then there's a fundamental piece of that to me. What do I actually believe? I believe if you own property that you rightfully acquired, that you should be able to build anything on it you want to, as long as it doesn't directly cause a problem for your neighbors. Period. And a big building that's awful quiet doesn't do that. So that's a fundamental libertarian principle, by the way, that what you should be able to do what you want with your land. I just want you to start thinking a little bit deeper. When you say you support something, what does that mean? Does that mean you pray for it? Does it mean you channel your mystical energy at it? Does it mean you made a post? Does it mean you wrote a letter? Or does it mean you wrote a check? Does it mean you showed up somewhere? Does it mean that you physically resisted it? Or you physically enable? What does support and oppose mean? It doesn't mean how you think or feel. It means what you do or do not do. So the same person is like, you should oppose it like I do. We've actually had the same net effect on the situation, haven't we? See, this is a very uncomfortable conversation. It shouldn't be, but it is. It's just how the human mind works. This is not about my opinion. If you're right now arguing with me in your head, you're missing the point. This isn't about my opinion. I've told you, I don't care what you think about it. And I don't mean that like, fuck off. I mean, like, I don't care. It's not I will not go to bed tonight wondering if Billy or Becky or Susie or Tommy or Joel or Ron or Robbie agrees with me. I don't care what you think. That doesn't mean I'm writing you off. It means that you don't, your thoughts on this thing that I know don't affect the thing don't matter to me, because the thing itself is going to either happen or not happen, regardless of how either of us feel about it. Let me put it a different way. Maybe soften it with something that's not so charged. If I think that a car, a particular model of car, looks best in red, and you think it looks best in black, I don't sit around going, man, I wish Bill would understand that that car should be red. I'm like, it doesn't matter. They're going to make black cars and red cars or whatever. And if we're already like, which car should they bring back? And I'm like, I think they should bring back a 68 Firebird. That's the car I think they should bring back. You're like, I'm with you on the Pontiac thing, Jack, but I think it's 69 GTO. And I'm like, no, man, 68 Firebird. You're like, no, 69 GTO. Okay. Are you going to go to bed worried about that? You know what? Neither one of them's coming back. And if I say I support the return of the 68 Camaro, and I oppose the return of the 69 GTO, what net impact does it have on the thing? Well, the answer is zero, and because it's some nebulous bullshit thing like bringing back a muscle car, except a couple of you are really mad right now. You're so stupid, it should be the GTO. Whatever, man. Thanks for proving my point. Most sane people are like, yeah, I wouldn't give a crap. Okay. Why? Because it isn't going to happen. Because it isn't going to happen. Now, if somebody said a certain team another team let go is going to pick them up, do you support or oppose that? What the hell does that mean? I mean, if you care enough to go picket in front of the team that's going to hire them and try to stop them from doing it, it may have no net effect, but at least you did something. But if you think a social media post amounts to support or opposition, you're delusional. But your mind doesn't know the difference. And it, when people tell me this, like, well, you know, they're going to surveil us. What are you doing? What are you going to do about it? I'm going to oppose data centers. Why don't you learn about privacy technology? Why don't you learn about privacy technology if that's what you're worried about? Because that's in your area of control. Are you right now using encryption on the web? No, shut up. You're literally being surveilled while you're making the post about being surveilled. I'm the one that's using encryption technology when I'm making the post. But you're public. They know who you are. Yeah, I don't care if they know who I am. I'm public. You're right. But that doesn't mean you know everything I do. And it doesn't mean that I leave a digital footprint everywhere I go, like you that supposedly the privacy advocate does. Do you keep all your data sequestered on, you know, a completely encrypted box where you can access it across a completely encrypted network? No. Shut up. Don't tell me about surveillance then. What step have you taken to prevent surveillance in your life before you tell me to do it? But you think you're going to do it by stopping a building from being built in whatever bumfuck town that's near you. Why? Because your mind is designed to make you think that. You're not. And if you're still hitting on the issue, you're missing the point. The issue's irrelevant. They're going to build the data centers. You're not going to stop it. They're going to continue to develop AI. You're not going to stop it. If you're worried about surveillance, and if you're worried about the use of artificial intelligence for propaganda and other things, then you better start learning how to use it and defend yourself from it. Or all you're doing is tilting at a windmill, Don Quixote. That's what you're actually doing. Oh, well, I thought this was going to be a short one, but there was more inside than I realized. Anyway, it's time to wrap things up. I appreciate you guys for tuning in today. If I haven't completely upset you, please consider tuning in next week when we will have a whole new week of content. And there just might be a super-duper surprise interview on Thursday. I won't say who it will be, and no, we don't usually have interviews on Thursday, but there is somebody who's reached out through proxies that wants to be on the air and had a time-date thing that they had to meet to be able to do it because they're important, and I'm willing to make an exception, but not while I'm on vacation in Colorado, which happened to be right when this person wanted to be on the air, right? So they're like, here's 4 days I can do it, and they're all right in the middle of my vacation that's been planned for 6 months. Nope, not doing it. Sorry, you're not that important to me. I don't know that anybody is. But if they can make it work, I will work them in on Thursday, and I have no idea what time of day it will be. So keep an eye out for that, and if they don't, I'm going to try to convince them that they can find some time after I get back. And if not, I'll tell you who it was, and you can go support or oppose the fact that they did or did not show up. Anyway, with that, everybody, have a great weekend. I hope you enjoyed today's show. Take care. The American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.